Hi, I'm Tony Cox, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of December 21st, 2012. Paying with cash may be passe, but swiping that credit card is getting to be old school, too.
346.
All right, 346. I open my Google Wallet app and enter my PIN. On the counter was that device you slide your credit card through. I tap the phone on it instead.
And tipping a little extra during the holidays is an American tradition, but is that tip from guilt or gratitude?
There's a very high expectation that you are going to tip regardless of the quality, and when you don't, a lot of times people make false attributions about the character of the person who would be the tipper in that case.
Plus, how do you keep a natural disaster from becoming a financial one?
We've just, you know, tightened the belt. Now we're taking what other insurance money came through for contents and trying to decide how far we can make that stretch to remodel and rebuild.
Advice from one couple who survived the Colorado wildfires 6 months ago. Those stories and more are coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Happy holidays, everyone, or should I say happy harrowing holidays. After all, there are last-minute deadlines at work, travel plans to coordinate, and that gift you just remembered you still have to buy. On top of all of that, there's the anxiety from the disturbing events in the news like the tragic school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and lingering fears of the fiscal cliff. And yet, it is Christmas, a time when we focus on what's good in our lives and on giving to others. So this week, we decided to take one last look at the world of holiday gifts, including gifts that don't come under the tree and new ways to pay for presents. We begin with Marketplace's Queena Kim, who reports that using credit cards and paying cash is so grandma and grandpa.
Google Wallet is an Android app, but I have an iPhone. So before I went holiday shopping, I drove down to Google's campus in Mountain View to borrow an Android. This is Marketplace. I'm here at Google with
Nathan Tyler.
So you got a phone here for me.
This is the Nexus 4. This is our latest Google Experience phone, which we're going to open for you right now.
Nathan Tyler is a spokesman for Google Wallet, and he turns on the phone and clicks on the app.
We've just opened the Google Wallet app. Do you have a Gmail address?
To use the Google Wallet, you need a Gmail account. And you have to input your credit card numbers, which Google stores to the cloud. The Google Wallet also requires a PIN. The process takes about 10 minutes. Oh, it's ready for you. So I just hit done. Cool. Done.
Okay, so what we're going to do right now is we're going to leave Google's offices and drive down to a 7-Eleven. Buckle up. This is your ride into the future of commerce.
When setting up this interview, Tyler reminded me that it took us thousands of years to go from bartering to cash to credit cards. And we're just at the beginning of this experiment in money. But Google is one of a slew of companies that thinks digital wallets are the future. And to get a glimpse of how it might work, we entered the 7-Eleven.
All right, so what do we have here? Donuts. You're too early for that.
Got to go back to work.
In the end, I got an apple juice and Tyler got candy.
346.
All right, 346. I open my Google Wallet app and enter my PIN. On the counter was that device you slide your credit card through. I tap the phone on it instead. Requesting transaction, it says, and then there comes receipt. Wow, there you go.
Yeah, it's really easy.
Tyler says ease is one thing, but the real benefit, once the digital wallet catches on, is going to be the deals you get.
The promise of the digital wallet is not that you can pay, but discounts, the digital discounts, that you can collect and save to your wallet.
Instead of clipping all those coupons and having to remember to put them in your wallet, it just shows up.
Yes.
Do you have to go seek out these or do they come to you?
The ones that we have today are featured inside the Google Wallet app.
As we do more and more on our smartphones, it collects more data on us. It knows what we're searching for, what we bought, where we are. And as Google Wallet knows more about us, it can send us deals that are relevant to us. That's the promise anyway. Of course, deals are great when you're doing holiday shopping. So I did mine in tech-savvy San Francisco. If Google Wallet worked anywhere, it'd be here.
I'm going to fire up my phone again. There's an option here that says offers. I've got buy any Whopper, get an original Whopper for 55 cents.
Nope, that deal's not for me. I'm an In-N-Out girl.
All right, so the Gap has something. And what comes up is a page that says 30% off regular item. And then a map with a bunch of gaps. And let's see if there's one near me. In fact, there is, just across the street.
The place was packed because everything was already on sale for 30%.
I headed to the sock section, where I picked out some designery socks to give as gifts. And then I stood in line at the register. Hey.
Anything else on your list today?
I've got this Google deal. I showed him my Google deal, and he was confused. He said, since everything is already 30% off, the coupon didn't apply. Do you guys take Google Wallet?
I never heard about it.
We do. Is this a Google Wallet?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about it.
Oh, cool. All right, well, I'll take the socks in. I looked for the device where you swipe your credit card, and alongside logos for MasterCard and Visa, there was Google Wallet. When it came time to pay, I tapped my phone on the device. Nothing happened.
It's not working yet, unfortunately.
Oh, but it says Google Wallet right here. All right, then I guess I'll just have to pay the old-fashioned way.
We're not tech-savvy yet, but we will be.
All right, here's my regular credit card.
Happy holidays.
Thank you.
That was Marketplace's Queena Kim, who joins us in studio now to answer a few more questions. Hi, Queena.
Hey.
So this didn't work so well every place, did it?
Yeah, it didn't really quite work for me, except for in that 7-Eleven. But to be fair, you know, these are the early days of the digital wallet. It's very much an experiment right now. You got to get the retailers to actually buy into this idea and buy the technology.
I understand why a consumer might want to do this for the convenience of it. Why would a retailer want to do this?
Well, the promise of online retailing as well as mobile retailing is that they can target you specifically. Because they're monitoring everything that we do, it's not that they just know that you're a woman and you're a certain demographic. They might see that you had gone online to buy something from Banana Republic. And then when you're near a Banana Republic, they can shoot you a coupon because they know you're already a fan.
You know, the cynic in me says, that's great, but
do we really need more stuff?
Well, the privacy issues. If they can do that, what else can they do?
I mean, I think right now it's so early that those concerns aren't being raised yet. But yeah, I mean, even in the app, there was that Burger King.
That was very interesting. So were you standing near a Burger King and it just happened to show up because you were there? Or was it you've gone to Burger King before and they knew it?
In the far future, it'll be because they've known I went to Burger King and they'll target me. This wasn't so much targeted. It was location-based. But what I thought of was, like, you know, there's so many concerns about your health and eating fast foods or sodas or whatnot. Like, you know, if I'm the kind of person who buys a lot of this on my wallet, could it be that one day, far into the future, insurance companies are like, oh, you know, she's a little bit of a higher risk?
What about the issue of keeping track of your expenses? One of the things that has happened as we have moved from a cash society to a credit one is that, you know, when the cash is gone, you know you don't have any money. But on your debit card or on one of these virtual wallets, how do you keep up with what you're spending?
Yeah, that's a good question. When we were in that 7-Eleven, you didn't hear it on the tape, but it was so much fun. We just did it again. You know, we just went and bought a bunch of other stuff. It didn't even feel like we were buying anything. It just felt like magic. But I think what Google would say is that they actually have a way to keep track of all your expenses, and you can tally it up. So it's on your phone all the time. And I imagine at some point you could probably sync it to, like, however you keep your personal accounting and whatnot.
So what is this tied to? Is it tied to my checking account, my savings account, a bank of any kind, credit card, what?
No, only your credit card right now. So you just input the credit card information.
One other security concern just popped into my head just now. I lose my phone. You know, somebody steals my phone. Can they just go out and spend my virtual money because they have it and there's no apparent, you know, password or PIN number, anything like that?
There is a PIN, actually.
Oh, there is one.
Yeah. So every time you use the wallet, and they're very strict about this, you have to put in a PIN. You turn off your wallet for a second, you turn it back on. The PIN has to be entered again. And actually, Google would say that unlike losing your wallet where you'd have to call up each credit card company, you can just go online on your computer and delete your credit card from the Google Wallet yourself.
Are there fees associated with it?
Not on the user's end. I don't really know what they're doing on the retailer's end.
You just sign up for this, but you don't have to pay, and they don't charge you when you go out and put it to use.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're not making money.
I guess you're right.
They're selling you those ads, and I'm sure, you know, eventually I think the idea is that they'll be making money that way.
Now, you know, there are other companies that are doing something similar to this. Is one company out ahead of the rest of the competition?
Well, the company that's making the biggest splash right now is Square. And they actually are envisioning a time very soon where you don't even have to tap your phone. Your phone just sort of transmits to the cashier that you're there. And then you go up and you order a coffee and they know that it's you, Tony, and then they take the money from your account. So that's a big company out there. I know PayPal, they're trying to get into this, you know, get into the digital space. I think Visa recently also even mentioned something like this. So yeah, it's a very hot space right now.
Marketplace technology reporter Quina Kim. Quina, thank you.
Thank you.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Christmas is make or break time for many retailers, and they're banking on your willingness to open your wallet wide during these last few days of shopping. That's especially true when it comes to buying the right gift for that certain child in your life. But hold on. Commentator Logan Sacken says when it comes to kids, leave the stuff on the shelf.
Before you judge me as a heartless Scrooge, hear me out. Picking out gifts is one of my favorite things, and really the only child in my life is my 2-year-old nephew, who I'm obsessed with. I love this little guy, and I wish I had the money to shower him in squeaky toys and stuffed animals and adorable designer shoes, but I don't. Before his second birthday party, I stopped at a kid's store, one of the nice ones with wooden stoves and intricately painted pretend food. I saw so many things I wanted to get him. I could picture us playing with a dollhouse and giggling about shiny pop-up storybooks. Oh, the fun we'd have bonding over all the stuff I bought him. Shopping for him was exciting and addictive, a lot like shopping for myself. I've accumulated thousands of dollars in credit card debt from self-gifting. Knowing those bills were waiting on me at home made it tough for me to justify buying more stuff, even if it was for my precious nephew. I left the store without a gift and arrived at his 2-year bash empty-handed. Ashamed, I sat on my hands during the present opening and felt a pang of regret when his face lit up at a new train set. I wished that I was the one who had gotten it for him, this beloved new treasure that would surely bring him endless hours of entertainment. Then an amazing thing happened. My young nephew put the gift box on his head like a hat and danced around with equal delight. And that's when I decided this gift-free approach would be my new norm. I will not buy him presents, not for his birthday, not for Christmas, not just because. Buying stuff didn't make me happy, and I'm willing to guess that me buying him stuff won't make either of us happy. Instead, I've named a savings account for him. And after that party, I made the first deposit. Last week, when I was tempted by the cutest pint-sized puffy vest, I made another. On my limited budget, I'd rather play the long game with that money than buy something he might love for a minute, or might not. I'm saving for him instead of spending on him, something I've never done for myself. I look forward to one day transferring the account to him. Until then, I'll remain the only one at the party sitting on my hands, but I won't be ashamed.
Logan Sacken is co-boss of one of our favorite websites, The Billfold. At this time of year, in theaters and school halls everywhere, Tiny Tim and Ebenezer Scrooge are strutting their stuff in Charles Dickens' classic A Christmas Carol. The story reminds us that the spirit of the season can transform even the most hard-hearted folk. But what if we've got Scrooge all wrong? What if he's really a model of frugality and good business practice? Reporter Christopher Worth in London took a fresh look at the real economic message of that classic holiday tale.
Nephew, you keep Christmas in your way, let me keep it in mine.
In the basement of a West London church, actors rehearse a scene from A Christmas Carol. Tony Bell plays Scrooge.
Bah, humbug!
Scrooge and his clerk, Bob Cratchit, sit in a freezing office on Christmas Eve. The year is 1843, and Cratchit tries to warm himself with the heat from a single lump of coal. At one point, Scrooge turns to Cratchit and asks,
You'll be wanting the whole day off tomorrow, I suppose.
If it's convenient, replies Cratchit.
It's not convenient and it's not fair.
Scrooge is the epitome of the bad boss. He keeps the thermostat low, you have to beg for a day off, and don't even think about an office holiday party. At least, that's the standard interpretation. Bruce Buena de Mesquita is a political scientist at New York University and the author of The Trial of Ebenezer Scrooge. He says we have Scrooge all wrong.
If you read the hard economics in A Christmas Carol, Dickens portrays Scrooge as a man who was generous to a fault.
For example, he claims Scrooge paid Cratchit more than the going rate in mid-19th century London.
A lot more. Bob Cratchit was paid, according to A Christmas Carol, 15 shillings a week. The average clerk in a counting house was paid 11 shillings sixpence a week.
So, although Dickens portrays the Cratchit family as poor, Buena de Mesquita says just compare Scrooge's lifestyle with Cratchit's.
Bob Cratchit owned a home. Bob Cratchit had enough money to have 15 rounds of gin punch and enough goose to feed the entire large family. Ebenezer Scrooge, on the other hand, lived in a rundown neighborhood and as little coal as Bob Cratchit had for his fire at the office, Scrooge had less.
And to save money, Scrooge works by the light of a single candle and eats nothing but a bowl of thin gruel. One might say he's a perfect example of how to live on a budget. Buena de Mesquita says at any time, Scrooge could have replaced Cratchit with someone cheaper.
But Ebenezer didn't fire Bob. He kept him on. He was a very good man. He's misunderstood.
Of course, Dickens might take issue with that interpretation. Florian Schweitzer of the Dickens Museum in London says there's no doubt that Scrooge is a miserable penny-pinching businessman, but
Scrooge is the embodiment of somebody who can change.
And change he does. Back at the rehearsal, Scrooge throws open his window after he's visited by three spirits and yells down to the street below.
Merry Christmas to everybody! A happy new year to all the world!
Then he sends a boy to the poultry shop to buy the largest turkey in the window.
We're going to send it to Bob Cratchit's. It'll be such a surprise.
But what happens to Scrooge and Cratchit's employer-employee relationship after Christmas? Sarah Squire is a fellow at the Liberty Fund who writes about Dickens. She says Scrooge's generosity can only last so long.
In January, Scrooge and Bob Cratchit are going to have to go back to the office, and they're going to have to come to some sort of meeting point between where Scrooge was previously and where Scrooge is on Christmas morning, handing out geese like there's no tomorrow, because there is going to be a tomorrow.
She says Scrooge would do well to balance his newfound enthusiasm for charity with his insatiable propensity to save. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
The holidays provide a chance for us to show our appreciation for the people who've done business with us throughout the year, giving a little something extra to the hairdressers, mail carriers, housekeepers, and doormen is part of our society's code of etiquette. The spirit of generosity is remarkable this time of year, especially to the people who rely heavily on tips to supplement their incomes.
Definitely do tip better during holiday seasons. The reason why, I don't know, but I guess it's just a thing to do like for holidays, like a thank you for helping them the entire year, I guess. Thanks for, you know, that extra little money. It does help.
80% of the people that come in, they're tip well. I would say the other 20, they're think about it. It's Christmas, it's forget about it. The money's out of the line and people should spend it.
Around this year, unfortunately, the company that I work for, we're not allowed to accept monetary gifts, but tips has been good as the fact of cookies, candy. I've been receiving a lot of those type of gifts, popcorn, all type of good stuff like that.
It's true, tipping is a way to say thanks to someone who has made your life a little easier. It creates a personal connection, even if just for a moment. And indeed, tipping is all about relationships. Holana Oakes is an assistant professor of political science at Lehigh University and an expert on America's tipping industry. That's right, it's an industry. And she's here to tell us how to navigate one of society's trickiest rituals. Holana, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tony.
The folks we may give a little extra to at the holidays are the people who provide us with some sort of service throughout the year. So we have a steady kind of relationship with them. I think we understand that. But how do relationships come into play when we're talking about tipping after a meal or for a simple cab ride?
I think relationships are the key. They're the critical component when it comes to tipping. Emotions are what drive the tipping norms. People tip because they care what other people think of them. And it really doesn't take that long. And we really don't even have to know somebody to really care about what they think of us. Individually, whether or not somebody can identify with the person that they're tipping, whether or not the person who's receiving the tip feels that they can make a connection with people, these things affect not only the size of the tip, the regularity of tipping, but also how people experience the norm of tipping itself.
Is it true that now there is simply the expectation to tip, whether the service was good or not?
There's such a strong norm in the U.S. for tipping. More than 90% of Americans tip, and we're tipping more and more occupational categories, and we're tipping more money when we do tip across those categories.
What kind of categories are we tipping now, for example, that maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we were not tipping?
One of the findings that intrigued me is that as we're seeing education become increasingly politicized, and as we're seeing access to the best quality education becoming separated, then we're finding that teachers in the wealthiest schools might be more likely to receive tips, whereas in the past we wouldn't see teachers getting a lot of tips. And we might get an apple from a student, and we might consider something like that a tip. But now what we're seeing is that parents are giving substantial tips in wealthier areas to teachers.
Are tips only money?
People who experience or receive tips experience a lot of things as a part of that norm. However, do we, you know, ultimately consider gifts a tip? I believe that people do. Yeah, certainly anything over $10 as a gift might be considered a tip.
Oh, so we know that it is ingrained in our social code here in this country, but it is not that way in most other cultures, is it?
Americans tip more and more often than any other country.
Really?
Interestingly, if we think about direct comparisons, a tip is highly unlikely in a place like Japan, where tips have a history of being, although this is changing, being perceived of as an insult. Americans really conform to tipping norms.
When it comes to not tipping, is that supposed to be done to send the message that I did not like the service, therefore I am not tipping you?
Certainly, my friends who are economists will say that's absolutely what you should do. If tipping serves any purpose from an economist's perspective, then not tipping will drive out those people who are not quite good enough to be in that occupation. It's not what people do. People tip for emotional reasons, and the people that we interviewed didn't make attributions about the quality of service when people didn't tip them, or when they weren't tipped enough, or when they were tipped a lot. People tend to make attributions about the character of the person who was supposed to. There's a very high expectation that you are going to tip regardless of the quality, and when you don't, a lot of times people make false attributions about the character of the person who would be the tipper in that case.
Is tipping a sustainable economic model for maintaining and generating business, do you think?
What we found in our study is that tipping does not serve as a clear signal about the quality of service, and it doesn't serve a monitoring function. So in the strictest economic sense, it doesn't have an economic purpose. It's an emotionally and culturally driven practice, and Americans are not likely to let go of it.
Holana Oakes is an assistant professor of political science at Lehigh University and co-author of Gratuity, a Contextual Understanding of Tipping Norms from the Perspective of Tipped Employees. Holana, thank you very much for joining us today, and happy holidays.
Thank you, Tony. You too.
We've all been thinking a lot about teachers in the wake of the mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. The holidays is a time we give them gifts, our way of saying thanks for looking out for our children each day, sometimes, as we now know, at great risk. There are 7.3 million teachers in this country, according to census data. Among them are countless substitute teachers who haven't always been portrayed in the best light in films and on TV. But what these real-life subs do in their day-to-day work life is a lot more than most of us realize. Laurel Benedict and Tyler Parsons are perfect examples. Laurel is a former full-time teacher now substituting in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Tyler was a sub until this summer when he got hired on full-time by his small district outside San Antonio, Texas. They join us now. Laurel, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
And Tyler, welcome to you as well.
Thanks. It's exciting.
Now, people have stereotypes of what the substitute teacher is, going back to their own experiences in grade school and beyond. But give us a sense of what being a substitute teacher is in today's world.
In today's world, technology is changing rapidly, and you have to be able to embrace the various technological changes. You have to be very flexible. I'm in a district where I have random calls. So I'm going from high school calculus to second grade elementary school. And over the 10 years, I've gotten a sense of what each of those levels requires in terms of classroom control, schedule. You have to have quite a bit of patience, love for children, and flexibility.
So does that mean you would be teaching, let's say, high school calculus on Tuesday, and you would be in a second grade class on Wednesday?
Exactly.
That must drive you crazy.
Well, you know, a substitute teacher has a bag of tricks. So when I go into calculus, which is a topic that is not within my realm of expertise, the first thing I ask is, who's the smart kid in the class? And they all point to one person instantly.
Okay. That is a pretty good trick that you have there. Tyler, how long have you been subbing?
I substitute taught last year for about half the school year.
Did you have similar kinds of experiences?
I did the same thing with an automated phone system. They also allowed you teachers to request substitutes. So through marketing myself, I was able to kind of land different jobs and find a niche market.
Quick question for you about how you marketed yourself. What did you do?
Our district allowed us to hand out cards, and they told me when I first got the job as a substitute that we could pursue jobs as aggressively as we wanted. So that could either be going up and down the halls handing out cards, which isn't very effective, or when you leave extensive subnotes, say what a great day you had, I could attach my personal business card, and then the next day I might wake up and I had been requested by a different teacher, and I find out that it was the teacher across the hall.
What is the hardest part for both of you about doing this job?
You start over every single day. Feeling that community can be difficult.
What about for you, Laurel, the hardest part?
Well, in the early days, it was the randomness of it. And when I'm having difficulty with a particular child, I will go over and have a quiet conversation with a student and remind them that they only have to put up with me for a half an hour. And then they're free, you know.
Now, how do you both make ends meet? Substitute teachers do not make what full-time teachers make. Give us an idea of what the pay is like to be a substitute teacher.
I started out at $100 a day and worked up to $125 a day, and it hasn't changed in 10 years. So I have many supplemental incomes besides that. When I first started, my full-time income was subbing, and I went as many days as I could. And in that first couple of years, I got up to nearly $19,000 worth of subbing. But at the end of the year, I was pretty burnt.
What about you, Tyler?
Fairly similar in Texas, depending on the district. My district was paying $50 for a half day and $80 for a full day. And then long-term rates were better. But it was definitely not enough with one income. So I was also, I'd work the school day, and then I would go work as a valet parking cars, and I would park the other teachers' or students' cars, and then I'd go do concession work, and I'd run into somebody there too, so people saw me in different jobs. It was funny.
As you know, the country's been talking a great deal about the events of Newtown, Connecticut. And as substitute teachers, both you, Laurel, and you, Tyler, are going into strange environments, strange meaning not a home base where you are there all the time and you have relationships that are long-lasting with the faculty, with the staff, with the students, with the parents. Do you have security concerns when you go to these different schools ever, Laurel?
When I walk in a school, I have maps, I have instructions. The emergency plans are next to the door in red folders so that there's no question about where to look or find or what to do. I was in two drills the week of that horrific thing in Connecticut. And so our district is practicing with these kids, trying to teach them how to handle the possibility of a lockdown or an emergency like that.
Tyler, you want to add to that?
I guess I would just say that you're not alone when you're there. There's teachers around.
Why do you both do this work? It can't be for the money. It can't be for the stability, because neither of those things exist for substitute teachers based on what you are describing to us. What is it?
I got into substitute teaching kind of as a foot in the door. I'm a fairly recent graduate from a master's in education program, and moving around the country with my girlfriend for her jobs, I've had to start over a couple times.
For me, I think I was a born teacher, and I was put in a position in Minnesota where I had been running a business with my husband, and he died, and so suddenly I had to support the family, and luckily I had a teaching degree in music, and I got back in the system temporarily. But about the time I did that, I was in my late 40s, and I never got tenure. So when I didn't get tenure, I had to make some choices about how to reroute my life. I tried a corporate job once and lasted about 7 weeks and decided that I was definitely a teacher, and that was my calling.
Laurel Benedict is a substitute teacher in Minnesota. Tyler Parsons was a substitute in San Antonio, Texas. Now he's full-time. Thank you both.
Yay, Tyler.
Yay.
You don't usually think of a wildfire or hurricane as a gift, but following the natural disasters that struck the Midwest and Northeast this year, those who survived say they've learned some very valuable lessons. One in particular, the importance of preparation. But how do you prepare for the unexpected and stave off financial disaster? Here's a firsthand lesson. Back in June, Mike and Sharon Gooley of Paradise Park, Colorado, were forced to evacuate when the biggest forest fire in that state's history blazed through their wooded neighborhood.
Well, we received word the day after we were evacuated that a firestorm had indeed swept through our neighborhood. One of the local news channels had flown over our neighborhood and took pictures. And we were able to see visual evidence that our house was gone, and that was terrible. But the good news was our studio with all of our business supplies was still standing.
It has been 6 months since Mike and Sharon lost their home in the Hyde Park fire, and we wanted to know how they're doing. Mike, Sharon, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having us again.
So the first question has to be, how are you doing now?
Every day is a different day. There are times that we're doing really good, and then there are times that emotionally it hits you, what has happened here. But I'd say in general, we're doing pretty darn good.
Now, where are you living? I know you lost your house and you lost another building next to your house, correct?
Correct. We lost a total of 6 buildings.
Wow.
But fortunately, our studio is still standing. So we've moved into the studio.
How does something like this change you? I know that you talked about that with us initially, but 6 months down the line, I'll ask this of you, Sharon. Are you different?
I am different. After the fire, it suddenly changed how I view things, and I realize some things really don't matter. And it makes me really focus on what is most important.
What about you, Mike?
The big thing for me is I'm going to slow down. We have worked so hard for so long in our business that it's time for me to back off a little bit and slow down. I've been up here on this land 31 years. It breaks my heart to see all those dead trees, but I also know that it's part of a system that will come back.
You had insurance, which you said responded quickly, but in the months since then, have there been other financial lessons that you have learned or any unexpected costs or expenses that you've incurred?
Everything costs more than you think it's going to. That's the big thing. We've hired people to come in here and to do some work for us. Some of it's worked well, some of it's not worked very well. As far as the insurance goes, we are very pleased with the way that all settled out. As far as finances go, we've made some decisions. We've paid off the mortgage. We've paid off all of our credit cards with the money that we got to have rebuilt the house. So now we're basically debt-free, and now we're going to take it long-term to start rebuilding things and probably never get into any sort of debt again.
Now we're taking what other insurance money came through for contents and trying to decide how far we can make that stretch to remodel and rebuild.
Without going too deeply into your personal finances, we would like to get some sense of what kinds of dollars we are talking about.
Sure. Basically, we ended up getting just a little under $500,000 for everything. And that is everything. Then, oh, go ahead, Sharon. What?
Yeah, the money from the insurance company, if you added in the loss of the house, the loss of all the outbuildings, because we lost six structures, the loss of trees, and the loss of contents, every single thing that added up in our policy, as Mike said, came to about $500,000.
$495,000 to be exact. But we've already spent about $430,000 of it, just paying off mortgages and debts and surviving for 6 months paying bills.
And we've just, you know, tightened the belt and we're moving forward and we expect next year things will get back to normal again.
Considering tragic events in the Northeast, particularly surrounding Hurricane Sandy and the victims there, what advice do you have for those people, many of whom have still not been able to put their lives back together?
It's a process. And the only way you can get through the process is realize, hey, today's another day. Get up, put your pants on, and try to stay as positive as you can and just take it one step at a time.
Part of the reason we were so positive before, we had support. We had friends. We had prayer. We try to be as self-reliant as we can. If we had lost it all, we could start over tomorrow because what's in ourselves, we knew that we could begin again.
You have one other thing.
Each other.
You have each other.
Sure. And we're just typical people. She annoys me, I annoy her. But life goes on.
Life does go on. Mike, Sharon, thank you again very much for sharing your story
with us. And thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's so easy to get caught up in the holiday spirit, the parties, the presents, the paid vacation days, fun, fun, fun. But there's always work to be done when it comes to keeping our money in order. And once we cross over to the new year, well, tax time can come surprisingly fast. So don't let it catch you off guard. Be prepared. And if you have questions about your finances, now is the time to ask. And what do you know, listeners wrote in to us and did just that. And so we have some of them on the phone, and we have invited CBS Money Watch editor-at-large Jill Schlesinger to help them out with their personal finance challenges. Hi, Jill.
Great to be with you.
Are you ready to go to the phones?
Ready to rock.
Laurie from St. Paul, Minnesota. Laurie, how are you?
I'm just great. I wish my stocks were better, but that's the way it goes.
All right. So what can Jill help you with today?
I invested in one kind of a penny stock, and the other stock I have was a company that actually went bankrupt. And so when I look at my portfolio, these show up. And for example, the one stock, I have two shares that are now worth 0.001, okay? And the other one shows me 20 shares at 0.097.
Hold on a second. So the penny stock, is that the 0.097?
No, I wish it was. The penny stock was the 0.001.
Uh-huh.
It's like worth nothing.
Oh, my goodness. Now, can I ask a silly question? Because I know I don't want to go relive the past with you, but what made you do this?
Well, the original stock was a facial identity stock, and it was back right after 9/11, probably a few years after, and I really thought Face ID was something that would go. Mm-hmm. And so when I bought 1,000 shares at 50 cents a share.
Okay. Where are these two stocks held right now? In what kind of account?
At my broker. Uh-huh. It's an electronic broker.
Okay. So in your electronic brokerage account, if you hit sell right mm-hmm. now, what would happen?
You know, I have no clue.
Because that's what I would do. Try to sell. I would absolutely sell them. And it doesn't matter what, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, you're like 0.097. You might worry. Well, what if it goes up by 2 cents? Who cares?
Oh, I don't care.
Right? So first thing I would do is I would try to sell it. Okay. That's number one. I mean, look, if it's a company that has actually gone bankrupt, the deal is that you just deduct it based on, you know, 0.001, and the IRS will let you deduct this loss. So, I mean, I think I would, first of all, I would, number one, try to hit sell as quickly as possible. If for some reason you cannot sell them, then you may actually be forced to move these into an account where somebody specializes in penny stocks. But my guess is you can sell them. You may not like the execution price. You might end up with even a deeper loss than the $830 or so. Who cares? The good news is once you get over this moment in time, it's not that terrible, you're going to say, wait a minute. I've got to be crazy. Who would buy penny stocks? Who would buy individual stocks? You know, if I give you all the data in the world, you know, Apple notwithstanding, all the great Google notwithstanding, it is hard to pick winning stocks, and it's really hard to pick winning penny stocks. So I would steer clear of them, take your losses, move on. Pinky swear with me that you're not going to do this again.
Oh, no. This is my first foray.
And last.
And last, too. Laurie, I hope that helps you decide what to do, does it?
Yeah, it does, actually.
Well, all the best to you, and happy holidays.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Jill, we have another caller on the line. This is Kay from Fullerton, California. Hello, Kay.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a senior, a retiree, and I have a question about life insurance as an investment strategy.
Hmm.
I have some cash been sitting in a bank doing very little, and then a broker who is affiliated with the bank approached me and said the life insurance is a good way to invest, and also the earning is substantial, and the most good part about it is the earning will be non-taxable. So he presented a real convincing case. However, you know, being a senior, always be cautious about being victimized. So I decided to call you folks for advice.
She made the right call, didn't she, Jill?
Boy, do I have a lot to say about this. Now, Kay, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm approaching 80.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so congratulations, first of all.
There
are a few bells and whistles that go off for someone like me. You know, I'm a certified financial planner. I was in the business of giving financial advice for 15 years. So, first of all, it is so crazy to think that there are people in banks who hold themselves out as quote unquote investment advisors when they're really just salespeople. So, the first thing I want to be really cautious about is for you to understand that when you go into a bank branch and they say, come talk to this investment guy, that person, that guy or gal, has actually no duty to tell you what's in your best interest. They don't have what is called the fiduciary duty. And so your big, huge yellow flag goes up right there. Okay. Number two, when I look at life insurance for people who are 80, first of all, this is usually, and I'm not going to say every single time, but I'm going to say, Tony, back me up here. Maybe 99 times out of 100, this is a bad idea. Because life insurance products, whether it's straight up life insurance or whether it is an annuity product, tend to be among the most expensive types of vehicles out there. So while you might get a better rate of return, you are paying for the privilege of getting that rate of return. And what I would caution you is that if you look at all the securities regulations, if you look at the SEC website, they have specific warnings against these types of behaviors. And unless somebody really needs life insurance, and at 80 years old, it would be hard for me to make a case that you need life insurance unless it's for some really crazy estate planning tool, I would avoid this like the plague. Tying your money up in insurance policy that is likely to cost you a lot of money, I think that is not advisable at this time.
Yeah, that's what my regular financial advisor said. But I said, well, it sounds good because it's a good way to pass it on to my grandchildren.
Right.
And also it's tax-free. And also it's going to be outside my estate.
Well, let me just be clear about one issue. The only way that life insurance proceeds pass outside of your estate is if they are held within an irrevocable life insurance trust. And that would mean that you'd have to go to a lawyer, establish a trust, have the trust buy the life insurance, and then it's outside of your estate. Otherwise, life insurance proceeds are added to your total gross estate.
I was told it is outside my estate.
No way. Life insurance proceeds pass to beneficiaries without income tax. Life insurance proceeds are always considered part of your gross estate unless the life insurance is owned by an irrevocable life insurance trust. And you would know whether you did that. You'd have to actually go to a lawyer, have the attorney draft, it's sometimes called an ILIT, I-L-I-T, draft the trust. The trust would then have to buy the life insurance policy. Then the proceeds are sheltered from the estate taxation. But you know what? If you have an estate that is under $1 million right now, you really don't have to worry about even if everything sunsets. What I think is probably going to happen with estate tax law is right now you have no tax due on the first $5 million of an estate. There's probably going to be some negotiation around that, maybe down to $3.5 million, $3 million. If it's under that amount, then this is just a sales hook that the banker/broker is giving you to get you interested in the product.
Kay, I appreciate your call. Good luck with this and Happy New Year
to
you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your answer.
All right, let's go into our third caller. This is Daryl from Montpelier, Vermont. Hello, Daryl.
Hello.
What is your question for Jill today?
Well, my dad wants to get his grandchildren U.S. savings bonds, as he has in the past, and he's always gone to the bank, and he got the paper bonds, and they put them in an envelope, but that's not available anymore, apparently.
No, that's so interesting, because that just started actually the January 1st of this year. The Treasury Department basically says no go on paper bonds anymore, and everything is electronic. Is your dad a little wary of the electronic purchase of these bonds?
He is. He's definitely not a Luddite, but he's... Yeah, I think he's kind of mistrustful of something so ethereal.
Well, you know, one thing to remind him, and I know this is maybe might not get him over the hump, but in many ways, I would say that buying electronically is safer than the paper bonds, because then nobody's going to lose the bond or tear
right.
the bond. But I understand that people get wigged out about this, right? You know, like, oh, I kind of wanted to do the paper thing, right? There is an alternative that he may want to consider. And that is, instead of buying double E bonds, he can switch over to I bonds. Now, the thing with I bonds is the only way you can buy them by paper is with an IRS tax refund. So if dad's due to get a refund, he can use the refund and actually buy I bonds with that refund. How old are your kids?
It's two families. So the kids all range from age 3 to 17.
I mean, he could just very simply open up separate accounts for the kids and, you know, pop an index fund in there. You know, there's a couple of cautionary tales I have about that. You know, for a 17-year-old, I wouldn't necessarily want to put the money in the 17-year-old's name, right? Because then the kid can do whatever he or she wants with it when he turns the right age, 18 or 21. Or maybe he opens accounts where the kids have some interest in the account, but he's still the owner. The Coverdell IRA accounts are real. These are education savings accounts. If he's putting in, you know, $500 or something at a time, that can be a good way to do it. But I think that if you can get him over this hump and have him go to treasurydirect.gov and read about how secure that website is, it sounds like that actually may be a better alternative for him, especially if there's lots of different kinds of kids involved.
What chances do you think there are of getting your dad over his digital fear?
It's worth revisiting.
Daryl, our time is up, but I hope that you got some information that will be of use to you.
Most definitely.
Thank you very much for calling. And Jill, it was always great having you on and taking those callers today. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large of CBSMoneyWatch.com. Thank you very much and have a happy holiday.
And happy holidays to you as well.
That is Marketplace Money for this week. Let us know what you think at marketplace.org or on our Facebook page. And keep up with the show on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, Gene Chotsky on money rules you need to adopt in the new year.
You've got to track your dollars like calories, which means know where your money is. Know what's coming in, know what's going out, and where it's going.
Marketplace Money was produced this week by Devin Maverick Robbins with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Gina Delvac. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tony Cox. Happy holidays. This is APM.